My brothers and sisters, I suspect that if you've been watching the news or listening to the news, you might think that we're in a period of great darkness. And I feel that. My heart breaks.
The Archbishop of St. Paul, Minneapolis, speaks to the faithful after the shooting death of yet another Minneapolis citizen at the hands of federal Customs and Border Patrol officers. Archbishop Bernard Hebda, but one of many Catholic leaders around the country and the globe, expressing alarm at the strong-armed and violent turn immigration enforcement has taken on the streets of America. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. After the death of Minneapolis ICU nurse Alex Preti and the unrest both before and after his killing, Archbishop Paul Coakley, president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, expressed his deep concern in a statement this week, saying the current climate of fear and polarization that disregards human dignity does not meet the standards set by Christ. In a step towards healing, he's called for bishops and priests across the U.S. to offer a holy hour of peace. Catholic faith leaders are now among the country's strongest voices for calm as the White House faces growing backlash over its immigration strategy.
A quiet and somber mood on Nicollet Avenue in Minneapolis much of this week. A makeshift memorial covered with flowers, candles, and posters marks the spot where 37-year-old Alex Jeffrey Preti, a U.S. citizen and ICU nurse at the local Veterans Affairs Hospital, was fatally shot by Customs and Border Protection agents last Saturday. At around 9 a.m., Preti appeared to try to get between federal agents and two women bystanders they'd shoved to the ground. A DHS report now states that two federal agents pulled their weapons and shot Preti. He was declared dead on the scene.
It's been alarming to me that we've had shooting and then another shooting and then another shooting, and nothing's changed.
Anti-ICE protests have erupted across the country in response to the shooting. Since December, more than 3,000 federal agents have been deployed to Minnesota under what is called Operation Metro Surge, the latest of Trump's immigration crackdown in America's largest cities. Preti's death comes just weeks after federal agents shot another U.S. citizen, mother of three, Renee Good. Preti's father told the Associated Press the killing of Good inspired Preti to participate in the demonstrations.
This looks like a situation where an individual arrived at this scene to inflict maximum damage on individuals and to kill law enforcement.
The administration has faced scrutiny for its hardline immigration enforcement actions in Minnesota, an effort largely led by Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem and Customs and Border Patrol Commander Gregory Bovino. But the administration has come under harsher scrutiny this week for initially calling Preti a, quote, domestic terrorist and claiming he attacked the officers. Noem said he was brandishing a gun. A 9mm gun and two loaded magazines were recovered from Preti, a lawful gun owner with a permit to carry. But video evidence and an initial federal review indicate he did not unholster it. A growing number of Republican lawmakers have questioned the administration's handling of the shooting, some joining Democrats and calling for Noem's impeachment.
She has taken this administration into the ground on an issue that we should own. We should own the issue of border security and immigration, but they have destroyed that for Republicans, something that got the president elected. They have destroyed it through their incompetence.
Though he first blamed Minnesota's Democratic leadership for the shooting, Trump held what he said was a productive call with Governor Tim Walz, where they, quote, seemed to be on a similar wavelength. And the president removed Bovino from Minnesota and sent his border czar, Tom Homan, to take over. During a press conference in Minneapolis on Thursday, Homan said the immigration enforcement will continue, but the efforts will be targeted.
What we've done for decades. When we hit the streets, we know exactly who we're looking for. Good idea where we may find them.
Amid those signs of de-escalation, Catholic leaders across the country and world have voiced concern over the fear and uncertainty over immigration enforcement action. Auxiliary Bishop Kevin Kenney of the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis told EWTN News the mood is still tense in Minneapolis.
We're coming together to help and support one another to love our neighbor, as Jesus says, and to continue to work towards peace and justice and the dignity that Catholic social teaching teaches us of human life.
Archbishop Bernard Hebda offered a votive mass for the preservation of peace last Sunday and encouraged all Catholics in the Twin Cities to join him in praying for Preti and his family.
And yet we know, brothers and sisters, that it's precisely into that darkness that Jesus comes to bring hope. That's what brings us here on that cold afternoon. It's because we know that on our own, we can't fix this situation, but that it's only the light of Christ.
The Vatican even weighed in on the tension in Minneapolis. Vatican Secretary of State Cardinal Pietro Parolin said the Holy See's position is always to avoid any kind of violence, obviously, and therefore we cannot accept episodes of this kind. The difficulties, the problems, the contradictions are resolved in other ways.
La pace si costruisce nel rispetto dei popoli.
During his Sunday Angelus, Pope Leo invited the faithful to pray for an end to conflict around the world, saying that peace is built on respect for people. While he did not mention Minneapolis, that call to peace inspired the head of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops to issue his own message of unity. In a statement this week, Archbishop Paul Coakley wrote, "It is with this in mind that I prayerfully urge calm, restraint, and respect for human life in Minneapolis and all those places where peace is threatened. As a nation, we must come together in dialogue, turning away from dehumanizing rhetoric and acts which threaten human life." Other bishops from New Jersey to Arkansas to Washington have spoken out against the immigration enforcement and the heated rhetoric it's caused. Archbishop Jose Gomez, whose Archdiocese of Los Angeles was the first epicenter of the White House's intensified immigration enforcement, wrote this week in his archdiocese's newspaper that America, quote, cannot go on like this. In the wake of last weekend's tragedy, I hope all sides in this conflict, federal authorities, city and state officials, and those protesting the enforcement actions, will take a step back in the interests of the common good. We are caught in a dangerous pattern of angry rhetoric, provocations, and violence. It needs to stop. Above all, these shepherds call for prayer and dialogue.
And to be able to see the gift of our relationship with brothers and sisters in the church, in the diocese, and to walk with them during these times, to be able to uplift the good that can come from situations like this, but to mourn the loss as well.
On Friday, Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche announced the Justice Department has opened a civil rights probe into the death of Alex Preti. And in another update, Homeland Security said it would hand over the shooting investigation to the FBI. Critics had said the earlier decision to leave the investigation with DHS meant that the department would have been investigating itself. The controversy in Minnesota has threatened to send the U.S. government into a partial shutdown. Democratic senators and some Republicans want to separate out funding for the Department of Homeland Security from the rest of a major spending package. They are calling for the department to follow new guidelines in its immigration crackdown.
Let's just get rid of the rogue activity. Let's move ICE back to where, you know, they identified themselves. They weren't traveling in roving bands without warrants. Some of the traditional protocols that they operated under, literally for years and years.
I don't think the Democrats can propose anything unless it looks like they are gutting Homeland Security and ICE like a fish. And that's not something that the Republicans are going to vote for.
The House must approve a Senate decision, and members are not back in session until next week. Agencies impacted by what appears to be a short-term shutdown include the Departments of Defense and Health and Human Services. But ICE remains funded through a domestic policy package passed last summer. In his call for a holy hour of peace, Archbishop Coakley reflected on how the violence, injustice, and social unrest seen in our nation this week might lead to feelings of powerlessness. But he emphasized our prayer, our faith, and our acts of charity do matter. He encouraged all faithful to take part in this holy hour and to pray for healing and renewal, confident that, quote, God hears the cry of his people and remains close to all those who seek him. And joining us now is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the newly elected president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Your Excellency, thank you for joining us. Can you reflect on this moment that we are in right now as a nation and why you felt prompted to call on U.S. bishops and priests to hold a holy hour for peace?
Well, I think I'm not sure it's an unprecedented moment, but I think it's a moment that has gotten the attention of our nation and indeed of our world. I think as we see the unrest taking place in our cities, particularly in Minneapolis and the violent outbreak. In view of the anger, the violent reactions that are taking place, I felt prompted, we felt prompted to try to change the tone of the conversations and call people not necessarily to avoid any kind of public witness, but really to call people to give witness by prayer, bringing our concerns, our needs, the needs of the suffering, the needs of the immigrants, the needs of our law enforcement officials, bringing it all to the Lord in the Holy Eucharist, to ask God's grace and God's presence, God's courage, God's guidance as we address very, very difficult and challenging situations on the ground. Mm.
God's guidance is certainly needed right now. And as you know, there were multiple news reports back in the fall about ICE preventing clergy from bringing Holy Communion to detained migrants. Now, with what's going on in Minneapolis, debates over immigration enforcement tactics continue to rage on. Your Excellency, how much of a priority is it for the U.S. bishops to address the growing debate over specific ICE enforcement strategies? Is this the top issue facing the U.S. church right now?
Well, it's an issue that we simply can't avoid because it's impacting so many of our people, both migrants, immigrants, but as well as law enforcement and just the people that are wondering, questioning in their own hearts and their own minds, what is the proper and appropriate response for Catholics, for Christians, for people of goodwill in the face of a nearly unprecedented situation. So I think it's a high priority, I think, for all of us. As was evident by the special message that we issued back in November at our fall assembly. So I think that was a message that was passed nearly unanimously by the U.S. bishops. So it's a very, very high priority for us.
Right, and that was the first special message in about 12 years from the U.S. bishop. So that is significant.
Right.
Do you have a sense of whether the situation in Minneapolis is on Pope Leo's radar?
It has to be. I'd be very, very surprised if it was not. I think he stays pretty well informed as to what's happening here in the United States, being the land of his birth, of course. But it's garnered worldwide attention and global coverage. So it's got to be on Pope Leo's radar screen and a matter of concern for him as well.
We understand you may not be able to address specifics here, though you are more than welcome to. But, Your Excellency, can you share whether immigration and ICE enforcement actions were topics of conversation during your recent meeting with President Trump at the White House? And are you satisfied by how those conversations went?
Well, I can say this, certainly, that the one takeaway that we realized almost immediately after that meeting was the relief that was granted for the R1 visa for the many religious workers working throughout our country who were facing real obstacles in renewing their visas and staffing our parishes as priests and religious sisters and religious workers everywhere. It's certainly been a factor in Oklahoma, where I am from, but it's been a factor all over our nation. I know as bishops were hearing that I was going to be meeting with the president, that was probably the one thing most consistently that I heard from them, to be sure to bring up that matter with the president, with the administration. And they listened and they heard, and I was satisfied, at least at this point, with the progress that we've made so far. We did discuss other matters, of course, in the time that I had with him, including meaningful immigration reform. So, yes, it was very much a part of the meeting and of our conversation.
Mm. You've described this moment that we're in of national turmoil as a climate of fear and polarization, which thrives when human dignity is disregarded. Can you expand on that? And what do you think is underpinning this polarization? How did we get here?
I don't think it's something that has happened overnight. I think we've been sliding in this direction for a number of years, of course. But I think we got here because of fear. I think fear is a tool of the enemy of our human nature, as St. Ignatius in Loyola would describe the evil one. I think he plays upon our fears, and this is a way in which he's playing upon the fear that's so rampant in our nation to turn to inappropriate means, to disregard, disrespect our brothers and sisters, to treat them as other, to treat them as the enemy, not realizing, not recognizing that the real enemy is not necessarily brothers and sisters of flesh and blood, but the real enemy is the evil one who is trying to turn us against one another, to be blind to the dignity of our brothers and sisters and their God-given dignity, created as image and likeness.
Mm. Well, on that note, finally, do you have a parting word for our audience, especially those who might feel fatigued by the national unrest right now?
Well, I as we've called for this holy hour, and I hope that will find a hearing in many parishes around our nation, I would simply renew the call to prayer. I think all of us need to turn to the Lord and seek his grace and to seek his guidance, but also just to inform ourselves and to be careful where we're getting our information. I mean, because there are some outlets, I suspect, that are playing upon these fears, and we need to avoid becoming pawns of those, that kind of spinning of information and facts, and to really begin with turning to the Lord in prayer and seeking his grace and his guidance. Mm.
That's a great reminder. Archbishop Paul Coakley, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this week.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. God bless you.
In the wake of another deadly shooting at the hands of federal agents in their community, priests in the Twin Cities quickly addressed the sadness, frustration, and fear of their parishioners. One pastor in St. Paul spoke candidly during his Sunday homily.
I'm tired. I don't know about you, church, but I am tired. Just when I think I have found the answer to this frustrating time that we seem to be living in, there is another hand that's dealt. Just when I think it's kind of hit a point where it can't get worse, I'm proven wrong.
And that priest joins us now. Father R.J. Fitchtinker is a Twin Cities native and pastor of St. Thomas More Catholic Community in St. Paul. He brings us a local perspective into how the faithful are dealing with the national spotlight and the ongoing turmoil. Father, thank you so much for joining us. As you just saw and heard, you began a homily expressing your exhaustion in the aftermath of the shooting of Alex Preti. For those of us who are not in the Twin Cities, can you capture how the local faithful are feeling right now amid this unrest?
Certainly. I'll try to do my best. I think the feeling immediately after being aware of the shooting on Saturday morning was a lot of fear. In 2020, after George Floyd was murdered, there was a lot of unrest, a lot of, protesting and a lot of things that really, you know, quite got dangerous and out of hand. And for us, I think the first thought was that might be what's happening again, right? Mm-hmm. After two deaths so close together in Minnesota, I think a lot of people were afraid. I think there's also this pervasive tiredness, this pervasive frustration around, our community not feeling like we have our own agency, our own ability to be able to respond to the various needs and the various things that are going on without sort of this excited, and I don't mean that in a positive sense, but this frustrating presence of ICE, this frustrating presence of people who seem to be behaving in ways that are inhuman or at least don't recognize the humanity or the dignity of those who, you know, are our brothers and sisters who are immigrants in this country. Mm.
And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that the Annunciation school shooting in Minneapolis was only about 5 months ago. So the local Catholic community,
absolutely.
You've been through a lot, your faith community. So we do just continue to keep the faithful there in prayer. Father, when there is a political flashpoint, such as the killing of Alex Pretty, and there are debates over immigration enforcement, people can instinctively cling to their politics. What advice do you have for how we can continue to love our neighbor, even when and especially when we disagree with our neighbor?
You know, I think the first thing is to do what Jesus did, which was to go in prayer, right? It sounds, I think that I'm praying for you seems to have a double-edged sword connotation in this modern era. And unfortunately, I think that, but that's the first thing that Jesus does, right? He goes to the desert. He goes off alone. He is often going to prayer, especially after any kind of significant ministry, whether it's been healing or whether it's after the return of the 12 disciples from being sent out. There is this sense in which Jesus invites us to always reconnect with the Father. So I think the first step is, in fact, like intentional prayer. And then the second is to divorce people from actions. And that can be really difficult, but that sense in which we recognize, you know, we can judge unjust actions, right? The killing of somebody, regardless of their status, by law enforcement, is, I think, always something that we have to look at with a sense that that's not the desired outcome that we want, right? We want something that is, part of, I think, a justice system that in the ideal, that the justice system will work and that we can participate in that. But when people are killed long before that process can even begin, I think we can say, okay, that action is wrong. But the people behind that, I think that we have to recognize, when we begin to become emotionally invested in our own opinions, I think we can create more division than actually being able to have reasonable, difficult, and hard conversations. I mentioned in the homily that I think social media makes it all too easy to unfriend someone when I don't like what you have to say, to be able to isolate myself from other people's opinions. And the reality is our world is complicated, and that art of having hard and difficult conversations is something that I think we need to rediscover. Mm.
That's a great reminder. Finally, Father, we just spoke with Archbishop Coakley, president of the U.S. Bishops Conference, about his recent call for bishops and priests to host a holy hour for peace amid ongoing unrest. What are your thoughts on that response, and do you foresee yourself taking that on?
Absolutely. I mean, already our community has had a peaceful presence during the afternoons in the week of people just coming together to pray and to sort of orient their hearts towards prayer and to ask for God's presence and to peace to be the number one response of our community. I also think that it follows the model of Jesus, right? What does Jesus do in crisis? Obviously, he heals. I mean, I think of his moments at the tomb with his friend Lazarus. He stops before he opens the tomb and says, "Father, I know you always hear me, but I do this for your benefit and for the people hearing me." And I think that that's an important reminder that we too, before any action, need to stop and address the Father, address the Lord, and be present. And I don't know of a better way of addressing the Lord in prayer than in adoration, in peace, and in prayer, in the beautiful silence that adoration and benediction can give.
Mm. Well said, Father. Thank you for your perspective. And again, be reassured for our prayers for your community. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
There is much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. Stay right there.
And I would like to be part of that group of leaders who helped to bring back higher education to its original roots.
With his Catholic faith as his guide, we travel to Dartmouth College in New Hampshire to meet the Ivy League scholar who wants to reform higher education.
Let's be honest, it's been very beautiful years, difficult years, may I say. You know, these years have been full of tensions at times.
Reflections on 10 years in America. We go on the record with Papal Nuncio Colonel Christophe Pierre.
I think it was a really good way to kind of, you know, showcase Stephen and his faith and just how much he enjoyed, you know, all of these parishes.
And we'll tell you about a special pilgrimage designed especially for a young man with autism. EWTN News in Depth is coming right back.
Spring of 2024, campus protests erupted at more than 100 U.S. universities. The pro-Palestinian demonstrators demanded universities sever financial ties with Israel over widespread deaths in Gaza. Thousands of anti-war activists were arrested. While many protests were peaceful, others led to school closures, student expulsions, and cancellation of graduation ceremonies. The protests put an intense focus on dysfunction and perceived anti-Semitism on American campuses. The presidents of several prestigious universities were called to testify on Capitol Hill. Under pressure, many resigned or were forced out. And confidence in our higher education system plummeted. Poor opinions about higher education in America were evident in a recent Pew poll in which 7 in 10 Americans said higher education is going in the wrong direction. But signs of hope might be emerging in the Ivy League. In an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal this week, Dartmouth president Sion Bylock called for reform of higher education in America, posing the question, is a four-year degree worth it? And suggesting that for the answer to be yes, colleges and universities need to make some changes on campus. On X, Bishop Robert Barron called the Wall Street Journal op-ed a great piece. He praised what he called Bylock's common sense solutions of making education more affordable, recentering education on learning rather than political posturing, and emphasizing equal opportunity, not equal outcomes, what he called music to my ears. A Catholic scholar at Dartmouth is playing a critical role in that reform effort. Santiago Schnell, a world-renowned biologist and former Notre Dame administrator, went to Dartmouth at the start of the academic year last summer to serve as provost. He believes the Catholic faith provides key insights for the reform of higher ed in America. Our colleague Jonathan Liedl, senior editor at the National Catholic Register, went to Hanover, New Hampshire, to learn more.
If times were different, Santiago Schnell might still be at Notre Dame. Not here, at Dartmouth College, as the new provost.
I wanted to stay in a Catholic university. I felt the moral obligation of leaving Notre Dame and serving on an Ivy to protect higher education.
Not just to protect higher ed, but also to reform it. In recent years, higher education has been engulfed in crisis. Some high-profile universities have become epicenters of activism and unrest, while ideological biases among many higher ed leaders have scandalized the nation. The Trump administration has cut off billions of dollars in federal funding to Ivy League and other universities in an effort to curb so-called woke culture, DEI initiatives, and anti-Semitism. That amid a Pew Research study finding that 7 of 10 Americans think higher education is going in the wrong direction. Respondents cited ever-rising tuition costs, poor formation for critical thinking, and the lack of viewpoint diversity as reasons for concern.
When you hear a statistic like that, how do you react?
We have been failing in the United States higher education. That's why the general public and the government are responding negatively. And the Ivies, they have served as a role model in a very negative way on how higher education should be moving forward. And the time for reform has arrived.
You talk about the need for reform. So in what ways do you feel that higher education, perhaps especially at the Ivies, has gone astray?
We have gone astray in the sense that we don't have intellectual diversity as we used to have. We have become very narrowly focused. And we have a lot of what I would say unearned certainty.
Schnell believes that this unearned certainty has led to a lack of imagination. As a result, faculty don't question their own beliefs or consider others, and universities have lost their originality.
When you look at what all other academic institutions are doing around the United States, we have become a very good imitator of each other. Mm. So the strategic missions and the plans and even the academic subjects we're covering, or even the the problems we're trying to solve, they're identical between academic institution to academic institution. And that wasn't happening until recently. It's a new phenomenon. And everyone notices. It's so obvious. And I would like to be part of that group of leaders who help to bring back higher education to its original roots.
And at Dartmouth, Schnell's found like-minded company. Under President Siân Bailac, the Ivy League school has emerged as a leading voice for reform. In her recent Wall Street Journal piece, Bailac called not only for making college more affordable, but also recentering it on learning rather than political posturing. Schnell is an important part of that effort. The Venezuelan-born, Oxford-trained biologist is a widely respected scholar. He even has a scientific formula named after him, the Schnell-Mendoza equation, which is used in biochemistry to determine how quickly an enzyme breaks down a substance during a reaction. And as the former dean of the College of Science at Notre Dame, he also has proven administrative experience. But Schnell also brings something else to the Ivy League, a vision of higher education firmly rooted in its Catholic origins.
The foundations of the university are very much the foundations that the Catholic Church provided. So we did that precisely because the Catholic Church, as a gift, wanted to educate the society to be more fruitful, to allow the individuals to flourish through the liberal arts. And even to this day, we still have the results of the Catholic and the Trinity all across the university mission. You know, I always joke that, people don't realize this, but we have undergraduate degrees, master degrees, and PhDs. And my Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And, you know, I feel very proud that I continue to be part of that tradition as a Catholic. I feel that I'm part of the heritage that has been moving through the centuries that I would like to keep alive.
We walked across campus to the provost's office, where we saw that the Catholic faith isn't just an abstract inspiration for Schnell, but is an active guide to his work. He begins every day with a prayer of St. Thomas Aquinas, asking God for wisdom. By his desk, he keeps a small cross, a replica of the Good Shepherd cross worn by Pope Francis.
When you're an academic leader, so you serve like a shepherd. So you want to make sure that everyone flourishes.
Yeah.
So it reminds me that I'm here actually serving the institution.
For further inspiration, the scholar is reading letters that St. John Henry Newman wrote while he was founding a Catholic university in Dublin in the 1850s.
So it's very inspiring for me as an administrator and as a Catholic administrator to see, you know, a person who tried to create a university from the ground up. Mm-hmm. What were the things that were working and that were not working?
Schnell's vision for higher ed centers on three elements: truth, friendship, and beauty.
We want to train every single student not only to be an effective user of the technical knowledge they acquire in the academic discipline, if they're going to be an engineer, but we want to be an engineer who can read poetry. We want to have an engineer who understands politics. We want to have an engineer who understands literature. Why? Because we don't want them to be trapped on a platonic cave where they're only observing the object from one direction. We want them to be able to walk through the cave and see the object reflect from different perspectives and realize that every time they stand in one place, they always have an imperfect representation of reality. The reality is much bigger of what they think originally, and in that way we create that certainty that it has to be earned.
And he wants other Catholics to join him in living out the academic vocation.
Imagine there's a young Catholic person out there, very intellectually gifted, also serious about their faith, and they're thinking about pursuing an academic career. We've talked a lot about the difficulties facing academia, but what would you say to someone like that?
Do not be afraid. I think the fundamental point, there's this misconception that if you are Catholic or you are conservative, if you don't hold the views that most of the people have in universities, you're not going to be welcome. It's complete false. So if you are really good at what you do, if you are excellent, everyone is going to respect you for what you contribute, even if it's different from what everyone else does. Remember that, you know, as a Catholic, so you come because you have this vocation, that you're playing part of the creative mystery, and you're helping to reveal the mystery of creation through the academic enterprise. In my opinion, there isn't a better way to be closer to God than actually doing that. You're going to be playing an important role in this world. You're going to have a position of influence. It's a unique and a special position to be in. So I want to encourage everyone who is a Catholic and is afraid, don't be afraid, do it.
From Dartmouth College, I'm Jonathan Liddle, EWTN News In Depth.
To see Jonathan's full conversation with Santiago Schnell, including his views on AI in the classroom and challenges specific to Catholic higher education at universities like Notre Dame, visit EWTNnews.com/watch. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. The return of the body of the final Israeli hostage in Gaza tops the Week in Review. Ron Gavili's transfer to Israel marks the end of a years-long emotional battle to bring home all 251 Israelis taken hostage during the October 7th attack in 2023. Gavili, a 24-year-old police officer, was buried on Wednesday. During his funeral, his father and brother recited the prayer for the dead, and mourners sang the Israeli national anthem. In Tel Aviv, a large clock tracking the duration of the hostages' captivity finally stopped after more than 843 days. With all hostages returned, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu promised to reopen the Rafah crossing for the first time in 2 years on Sunday, allowing Palestinians to enter and leave the enclave. He says his priority is now to demilitarize Hamas. New details paint a grim picture of the brutal crackdown on unrest in Iran. Iranian officials say some 3,000 protesters have been killed since anti-government protests began 1 month ago. But activist groups claim that the death toll of demonstrators is much, much higher, with some now suggesting the count could be well over 10,000. An internet blackout makes it nearly impossible to track just how devastating the crackdown has been. The widespread protests began in response to Iran's currency plummeting in value. This week, it fell to a record low. The Trump administration is facing its first legal challenge by families of men killed in small boats off the coast of Venezuela in what the Defense Department has called kinetic strikes against narco-terrorists. The families of two victims say their loved ones were fishermen, not drug runners. Their wrongful death lawsuit was filed this week, accusing the U.S. government of conducting extrajudicial killings and unjustifiable use of deadly military force. The U.S. has carried out 36 strikes on vessels at sea since September 2nd, killing at least 125 people, according to data released by the Pentagon. The Trump administration has defended the strikes as legal, but the lawsuit says the Defense Department has not released any evidence at all to support assertions the boats targeted and people killed were affiliated with any drug cartels. The boat strikes were part of a U.S. campaign against Venezuela, which the Trump administration accused of waging a narco war against the U.S. Then, earlier this month, the U.S. military captured Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro in Caracas and replaced him with his vice president, Delcy Rodriguez. Under pressure from the U.S., a new development this week. On Thursday, Venezuela's National Assembly approved a sweeping overhaul governing its oil industry, allowing greater U.S. involvement. Also this week, for the first time since the Maduro capture, Congress got to ask tough questions of the administration when Secretary of State Marco Rubio appeared before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
I'm not here to claim to you this is going to be easy or simple. I am saying that in 3.5, almost 4 weeks, we are much further along on this project than we thought we would be given the complexities of it going into it. And I recognize that it won't be easy. I mean, look, at the end of the day, we are dealing with people over there that have spent most of their lives living in a gangster paradise. So it's not going to be like from one day to the next, we're going to have this thing turn around overnight. But I think we're making good and decent progress.
Rubio was also questioned about areas of tension between the White House and longtime NATO allies, including the Trump administration's recent comments about taking over Greenland that have antagonized and threatened the alliance. Rubio downplayed concerns the president is undermining NATO, saying that European nations comprising the alliance need to strengthen themselves to become better partners, and that ultimately readjustments would work out. The National Transportation Safety Board has issued its safety report 1 year after the deadly mid-air collision between an American Airlines jet and Army Black Hawk helicopter near Reagan Airport in Washington. 67 people died when the plane and chopper plunged into the icy Potomac River. The safety board released these simulated views from the cockpits of both the jet and the chopper. Neither pilot could see the other's aircraft until split moments before they collided. The NTSB cited no one single cause of the crash, but rather numerous systematic failures, including years-long concerns about a helicopter route so close to congested commercial airspace.
How is it that no one, absolutely no one in the FAA did the work to figure out there was only 75 feet, at best, 75 feet of vertical separation between a helicopter on Route 4 and an airplane landing on runway 33.
This NTSB photo of the recovered wreckage shows where the chopper's main rotor collided with the underside of the jet's left wing. The NTSB safety recommendations include limiting landings on runways that overlap with chopper routes and rerouting Army operations away from Reagan National Airport. A happy milestone of note now regarding the Vatican's representative to the U.S., Cardinal Christophe Pierre, turned 80 years old this week. This marks his theoretical time of retirement from official duties, meaning his nearly decade-long stretch as apostolic nuncio to the U.S. is coming to an end. A large part of his latest diplomatic assignment consisted of overseeing the episcopal appointments across the United States. But Cardinal Pierre's time in the U.S. was marked by profound division in our country, including the COVID-19 pandemic and nationwide protests. As the Pope's U.S. representative, Cardinal Pierre's agenda was full, from attending Capitol Hill hearings in Washington, D.C., to promoting the late Pope Francis's emphasis on synodality to the U.S. bishops. He helped the faithful foster devotion to the Eucharist as part of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage and at the U.S.'s 10th National Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis. Cardinal Pierre traveled and spoke at many Catholic events and conferences in his role as Apostolic Nuncio, including at the New York Encounter. Cardinal Pierre has served as papal nuncio here in the U.S. under two different popes and three different presidential terms. The French prelate has had to navigate church diplomacy in a way where he guards against being political and remains pastoral. He recently joined me to reflect on his time in the U.S. with this on-the-record interview. Cardinal Christophe Pierre, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Very happy to be with you.
In your role as papal nuncio in the United States during the Francis pontificate, you did accompany the U.S. bishops through some moments of tensions, you could say, between the Vatican and the USCCB. Do you foresee those tensions diminishing with our new pope, or are you already starting to see that now that we have this U.S.-born pope?
Well, this is a difficult question. You know, we have to be very careful when we speak about the tensions between the Holy Father and the bishops, you know. I think the tensions are normal, we are not in a war. I've never seen a kind of war. Sometimes, you know, some people have said the bishops in the United States are at war with the Holy Father. This is not true. I think, I've been 10 years here, and I've been working in 9 countries, you know, for the last 50 years. I would not say that the American bishop is at war with the Holy See or with the Pope. Mm-hmm. You know, at times, the Bishops' Conference is nearly 200 dioceses, 300 bishops, active bishops. We don't, and we have all these retired bishops. So, we have to organize ourselves. We have to work together. Right. At times, it's difficult, you know, to understand each other. And also to understand, the leadership of the Pope. Mm-hmm. And, may I say, and that has been my experience, I worked with Pope Francis a number of years since he became a Pope. Mm-hmm. And Pope Francis, as I said, has been a magnificent leader. Mm-hmm. And the reason of my admiration is that his intuitions, his capacity to discern where we are in today's world, and to give orientations and directions for how to evangelize the world. Mm. So for that reason, being the world what it is, you know, a very difficult one, precisely with the difficulty to transmit, Pope Francis has provoked us all the time. And at times we don't like to be provoked. Pope Francis used to avoid, you know, we have to go out of our zone of comfort. Right. Our tendency, all of us, even bishops, you know, to remain in our zone of comfort, to think that we know it all. Hmm. But, you know, the role of the Pope precisely, and this is the reason why he has been sent by the Holy Spirit, mm-hmm. is precisely to help us to go out of our zone of comfort, to take risk, and to discern where we have to go in order to respond to the challenges of the time. Mm-hmm. And I think the difficulty for many of us bishops, you know, in relationship with the Pope is to understand at times people said, you know, for example, the synodal process. What is the synodal mm-hmm. process? You know? And many people said, well, we don't know where to go. We don't know how to work together. The Pope said, continue to work together. Continue to discern. Mm. Continue to listen. To listen to one another. To listen to the world. This is precisely what Pope Leo will do. You know, he wants to meet the young people, to listen to the, but also he want them to listen to him, mm. you know, because he's the leader. So I think the challenges have been at that level.
You have served as Apostolic Nuncio here in the U.S. since 2016, nearly a decade. How would you even begin to characterize these years here in the U.S.? You know, what have you taken away from the church here in the U.S. this past decade, a decade of serving the church that's been marked by pandemic?
Yes.
Nationwide unrest, assassination attempts on yes. political candidates and activists. And then there was also, though, the Eucharistic revival. How do you begin to reflect back on what these years were marked by?
Well, this, let's be honest, has been very beautiful years, difficult years, you know, may I say. You know, these years have been full of tensions at times. The tensions come from ourselves at times, you know. The challenge to work together. To live in a very polarized, as we say, you know, it's a kind of, everybody says that, but mm-hmm. it is true, you know, mm-hmm. a polarized society, yeah. and to remain faithful to the mission of the church, you know. And the mission of the church is precisely not to reproduce in our church the polarization of the society, but to be a kind of place where we can heal, you know, mm-hmm. And help the people to rediscover a kind of unity, which should never be an artificial kind of unity, because, you know, the process, the church is should enter into a more serene process of education. Mm. I think the Eucharistic renewal, revival, as we said, you know, has been a kind of helping people to rediscover what is the center mm-hmm. of the church, and the center of our missions is the presence of Christ, and the presence of Christ in our lives, and Christ who gives himself in the Eucharist so that we may be fed and transformed by his presence. At times we forget about that, and we remain, you know, we became, as we said, you know, cultural warriors. So that means instead of contemplating Christ in my life, in your life, and trying to get together, we remain at the level of ideas. So if you don't agree with me, you become my enemy, mm-hmm. or I mm-hmm. become your enemy. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is very dangerous, because even with beautiful ideas, mm-hmm. you know, the ideas, Pope Francis always said, you know, and that's one of the four principles he gave in the, you know, Evangelii Gaudium, the first document, you know, the reality is more important than the idea. Hmm. And sometimes we give more importance to the idea, and from idea you have ideology. Right. So we become defensive of ideologies, and we put in the ideology what we like. But in the church, we don't fabric ourselves the church. We receive it from God. And we receive the gospel as a gift, but in the ideology we fabricate it. So at times we take, there is this idea which mm-hmm. interests me, I put it in my ideology. This one idea, I don't like it, I put it outside. And at times, we become more politicians than the church people.
You've served as nuncio in Mexico and, again, here in the U.S. You've seen the migration story from both sides of the border. Can you share your insights on that? And what is your message to the church and the U.S. when it comes to the topic of immigration?
You know, since I've been here, I've been always full of admiration for the role of the church in the field of migrations. And I think it continues, you know. And in this, I've not seen any division, you know. In the church, the bishops are together. And I'm very proud of this church, you know. I think, you know, we should not be afraid, you know, to speak up when it is necessary. Because, you know, we are part of the society, you know. And a society should allow the people to speak up, you know. The question, migration is one of the issues, which is very, very strong one. It has to be resolved. You know, at times, problems arise because the questions have never been resolved properly. And the role of the politicians is precisely to resolve the problems. Otherwise, they are useless. If they don't resolve the problem, they create problems. And I think, the church is, you know, the church is made of citizens. And by the way, don't forget that, you know, the Catholic are about 80 million people in the United States, and 40% are recently come from the migrations, particularly from South America. So, you know, should we abandon these people or not? They are human beings, by the way. And the center of our message is the value of the human person.
Cardinal Christophe Pierre, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Cardinal Pierre tells me when looking back at his time in the U.S., he greatly admires the dedication and enthusiasm of both the Catholic bishops and the faithful here. A happy 80th birthday to His Eminence.
He would always just be drawn to the Divine Mercy image of Jesus. He's like, there's my friend Jesus.
Next, a Catholic family creates its own journey, a pilgrimage of sorts, to help their son with disabilities fully embrace the faith. We'll be right back.
The Jubilee Year of Hope may be over now, but its impact continues. When he launched the Jubilee, Pope Francis urged the faithful to become pilgrims of hope. And as a response to the call, each diocese in the U.S. designated pilgrimage sites for people to visit. One family decided to go above and beyond, visiting all parishes and mission churches in their diocese. The impact on their son with autism was profound. Reporter Roselle Regis has their faith journey in depth.
What did you like most about visiting the churches?
Visiting Jesus.
He loved visiting Jesus and seeing in all the different places.
Stephen Buchanan has always been in love with a faith since he was just a young boy. According to his mother, Lisa, at 2 years old, Stephen was diagnosed with autism. But despite communication challenges, Stephen is able to express his love for Jesus.
Stephen has always just loved church. Whatever it is, it's always a place of calm and serenity for him, I think. He goes in and he just kind of relaxes, and he just loves praying.
Over the summer last year, the Buchanan family visited a new church, and Stephen was thrilled.
We thought, okay, so we went to one, and I thought, oh, this would be really fun. We should try to see how many churches in the diocese we could, you know, go to.
This sparked a new idea for the family, inspired by the Jubilee Year of Hope, in which Pope Francis urged the faithful to go on a pilgrimage to designated Jubilee sites. The Buchanan family decided to go on a mission to visit all the churches in the Diocese of Arlington, Virginia. More than 80 diocesan parishes and mission churches in 21 counties, spanning roughly 6,500 square miles.
I mean, 85 churches, lots of different designs, all centered on Christ. It was really cool to see how different parts of the diocese and different parts of really our state, because, you know, the diocese is huge.
His parents decided to document their journey on Facebook so people can follow along and join in prayer virtually.
What we would do is I'd post on my Facebook page with pictures, talking about, you know, the history of the church, that specific church a little bit, just pictures. We would pray for people. If people asked for intentions, we would, you know, make sure to pray for them.
Fueled with excitement, a love for Jesus, and a lot of gluten-free pizza, the Buchanan family completed their mission in 15 weeks. At each church, Stephen enjoyed looking at different art pieces and would pray the Hail Mary before leaving.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee.
In a lot of the churches, he would always just be drawn to the Divine Mercy image of Jesus. He's like, there's my friend Jesus. He would always just want to go and get a picture with Jesus or get a picture with Mary.
Family members and loved ones were able to join them on parts of their trip. Stephen's twin sister Cecilia said her brother has a special relationship with Jesus.
It's obviously different, but it's such a blessing. He sees faith, he sees Catholicism differently from most people, which is really beautiful. Just seeing his perspective on Jesus, the saints, it's really cool.
One of Stephen's favorite places was the newly renovated Cathedral of St. Thomas More in Arlington, Virginia.
Anywhere he goes, all the priests are so friendly
Oh, yeah.
And so wonderful to him. They see him as a gift from God, and I'm really glad for that.
Hi, Bishop Michael Howard.
Stephen's parents are grateful that the faith community is very open and accepting of people with special needs.
Jesus would always say, you know, welcome to me, little children, welcome, little children. And I think for disability, they're the sort of the most pure form.
Stephen, even though he's 19 years old, has the faith of a child. I would also argue that he is a great example of how we need to welcome everyone to the church, no matter who they are.
As a gift for completing the pilgrimage, Bishop Michael Burbage of the Diocese of Arlington presented a special gift to Stephen, a rose window. The Buchanan family hopes that their unique spiritual journey will inspire others. Rasal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
Amazing. And that's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.